Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Let the filibustering begin.
Welcome to Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to Filibuster here on the Nerd Party. On today's episode, we'll take a look back at the 2020 London Film Festival that was predominantly digital and online, discuss how successful it was in its new format, and then count down our top three highlights from the fest. I'm Dallas King, and joining me as always is my partner in crime, it's Lee Hutchison. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. I just got back from London, which is my couch, just seconds ago. So yeah, it's been a nice commute from one festival to the podcast booth.
Absolutely. You know, we like to keep, as always, we're maintaining our social distancing at all times until we can finally meet up and go back into a cinema. Because even now, I don't know if our two households allowed to go in together at the same time, potentially perhaps, but whether they'll get to sit next to each other, who knows? But this year's London Film Festival was a change. You know, if you've been following the podcast for a couple of years, you know that Lee and I are normally found down there for at least a few days, a week, maybe even two, sort of hop-footing it from screen to screen in Leicester Square, or mad dashing across the embankment to get to the BFI South Bank, standing out in the cold on a red carpet, hoping to capture the attention of some major star to come over and talk to us. But this year, we were sitting on our couches or our beds, on a chair, at home, watching films on our laptops, our TVs, if you were lucky enough, or for me, because my laptop wasn't compatible, my iPhone. So, Lee, what did you make of this year's alternative for the London Film Festival? You know, they did manage to get a full festival out, you know, credit to them, but what did you make of this slightly different format?
I think so much credit goes to the team at BFI and the London Film Festival for pulling this off. Obviously, it didn't go without a hitch or anything like that here and there. You know, only minor things really got in the way. But, you know, you have to say what a fantastic effort to pull all this together. The fact that they put on press screenings for free, you know, all you had to do was obviously apply for accreditation. And you got in, you got access to all these movies that I think cost maybe about £10 or something to rent on the BFI player. So, you know, a fantastic way to be inclusive. Obviously, we spoke before, it was disappointing that, you know, there was a lot of great independent cinemas that were, you know, locked out of the festival that I think would have really, really helped and shown a lot of support to these cinemas in really trying times, you know. But we got a London Film Festival. It may not have been what we anticipated at the start of the year, but we got something, and it was safe to say it was interesting for a couple of weeks on social media to see everyone kind of united behind watching films, talking about films, supporting independent British films, you know, a lot of original work. You know, I think, you know, it may not have been the most exciting year that there ever was for the films, but there was more than enough hits in there that I think that left people more than happy and satisfied. And I think it's hopeful that there's enough films in there that are going to get people's attention when they maybe get distributed a bit wider to different audiences.
Yeah, because this year there was 59 feature films. I think that was the tally there. I, in the end, watched 24 films, reviewed 13 for Flick Feast. 11 of those films were directed by women, and 7 of those were foreign language films. So I feel that I did okay. I think that's probably more than I did at last year's festival, but then I was only there for, I think, a week. And it's a lot more difficult, I think, when you've got that physical run of screenings where you're having to dash from one to the other. You kind of have to prioritise. Also, I guess, because there wasn't the opportunity to do red carpets or really sort of any interviews. I mean, I know they did a couple of virtual afternoon teas, but unfortunately for me, I don't know how you found this. Did you do any of those? Because I found that I was only interested finding a film that I really liked and then was like, oh, the director's doing that. And it's basically, it had already passed and I kind of missed my chance. Because it was only like, it was a lot of the smaller films that I discovered that actually really liked, and I would have liked to have chatted to them by that point. It was kind of too late. Did you, because you're always great at sort of doing interviews and stuff like that, did you manage to do anything this year, or did you kind of just sort of park that for for the time being.
I chose to just to park it. I think it was one of those ones. I think with it being working from home and then doing a virtual festival at home, and I kind of had the 2 weeks off for the festival, and I decided to keep the 2 weeks off to, you know, just enjoy getting away from work for a little while, you know, a change of scenery and pace. I was sitting there thinking, you know what, I don't want to be chasing up emails. I mean, I do enough of that in my day job. I don't want to be chasing up emails to try and interview people. So I just thought, you know, this year I'm just going to enjoy the films that I can and just relax into it. You know, it can be frustrating sometimes. You're sending off emails looking to chase up people, especially at festivals. You know, there's so much competition. There's hassle and strain. It's one of those things I thought, not this year. It's not the same. And, you know, while the afternoon teas were fantastic, they would be sort of towards the end of the day. And I was like, you know what? I've watched enough films for the day. I want to go out and get some fresh air now. I want to be able to enjoy a bit of time off. So I just focused on the films this year. And but no, again, it's another amazing thing. Like, just because we can't meet at the Mayfair Hotel for literal afternoon tea and chatting with writers, directors, there was still that opportunity. You know, they really did salvage something. And I know people that got to attend some of these interviews or events and so on, and they proved really popular and a great way to kind of get to a lot of different people. So again, it wasn't for me this year, but fantastic that they did.
Yeah, did you do anything to your living room and sort of set up to try and recreate that sort of cinema atmosphere? I mean, how did you find the screening portal? Because I know in the previous episode we were kind of a bit grumbly about the fact that, say, New York, for example, had given like a 48-hour window to watch a film, but with these ones it was, you've got to press play within an hour of the film starting, otherwise you'll lose it. And they even had to put up a disclaimer that they did not advise people press play and then pause to come back to later in the day because you could lose connection and stuff like that. I mean, how did you find the screening portal overall?
It was pretty good. I mean, apart from those complaints, I don't understand why it just had to be an hour, because again, you exclude people from the process. You know, yeah, you can maybe reach out for a screener or something like that, but you've got to give people a chance to, not everyone's going to be available for a 9 a.m. screening, you know, especially sort of during working weeks. You know, if you want to include people, you know, you maybe have, even if you're being generous, you have a morning screening, maybe an evening screening of whether it's something like American Utopia or something like that. Give people more chances to see these films, as opposed to giving kind of incredibly narrow windows. And again, you'll get more reviews out of people, more chance for people to engage with the film and feel part of the conversation. It just felt like an unnecessary kind of thing. For me, I by and large would stream from the platform to my Apple TV. There was an option to do that, but unfortunately, unlike the cinema screens, I had to every so often just tap the mouse pad on my computer, or else it would disconnect from the Apple TV, which was incredibly frustrating. And there'd be just times I would just have it on my laptop, because it would take me out of it just having to just keep touching the keypad. So it's little things like that. I'd love to see if we're going to definitely see some more virtual festivals, I think, at the start of 2020. You know, have an online app where people can watch these things somewhat uninterrupted through their Apple TV, Firefox or whatever, you know, all these sorts of things. I think there's ways to definitely improve it. But, you know, for a first year going into something like this, very well done.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think overall, I think, you know, it's huge credit to BFI and to being able to pull it off. I mean, there was minor issues. I think a lot of people had trouble with it. I think it was Kajillionaire, I think, just froze for a lot of people. I didn't personally have a problem with it, but, you know, there was a couple of times where it was sort of sticking a bit and you were like, oh, I think it was like, I was about 10 minutes from the end of Supernova and it kind of froze and I was like, oh God. And I had to basically come off my Wi-Fi and then go through mobile data, and that sort of kick-started it again. But I thought I was going to, there's nothing worse than sort of thinking you're going to miss the last sort of 10 minutes of a film or something like that. But again, that's why nothing beats the theatrical experience for me, you know, just that thing. To the point where I even tried, and a lot of people seem to like this tweet that I put up on Friday ahead of Nomadland. I walked into town, got myself my McDonald's breakfast and a coffee, came back and then pretended to sit on my doorstep for 2 hours waiting to get into my screening. And a lot of people seem to like that. So yeah, that's kind of what I miss, the personal sort of aspect of just getting up ridiculously early and chatting film with people before going to watch a film and then getting that sort of immediate reaction. Yes, you can do it on Twitter and stuff like that, but it's not the same, is it? But you know, now it's time to find out, I guess, what we did enjoy about the film festival. And a couple of weeks ago we did our preview episode, and in that one, I selected three films, and Lee, you also selected three films that we were looking forward to. I selected The Intruder, New Order, and One Man in His Shoes. And Lee, you picked Limbo, Possessor, and Undine. So I guess it's time to find out if any of those made our final lists. So Lee, what is the first film that was one of the highlights for you?
This is one that I purposely excluded from my list because I thought it was it's a bit of a gimme, especially if you're recommending people to check out films. You're kind of trying to want to give a nice little spread. But I went with Mangrove, one of the first movies in sort of Steve McQueen's Small Axe kind of series that's going to be dropping later this month on, is it? We're still in October, in late November, on Amazon and BBC. And that's obviously the true story of the Mangrove Nine and the trial that took place in the Old Bailey in 1970. So I think the film was potentially in trouble for me, you know, kind of the first week I saw it, because I'd just been hot off seeing the trial of the Chicago Seven just a few days later. But, you know, I have to give confidence to this film. It had, instead of seven, it went for nine. You know, obviously that's a positive sign as well.
So it must be two better already.
Exactly, yeah. I thought it was an excellent, because it was one of these things I knew nothing. I'd never heard about this situation or case. Didn't even kind of pop up on my radar. And I suspect for 99% of people probably attending this festival, that was probably the same as well. But, you know, it was such a really interesting insight into sort of what the Metropolitan Police were doing in London in sort of the 70s. I mean, I was ignorant about the Mangrove case, but I'm not ignorant about the history of racism and institutional racism, it should be added, with the Metropolitan Police. And I just thought it was just packed with so many great performances, and it's one of those ones, it's such a fight for justice. You know, you're screaming at the TV for them to get just a fair shot at a trial and so on. And I'm so excited. I've seen two of the Small Axe series of films, this and obviously Lover's Rock was at the film festival as well. I'm desperate to see the rest of this series, and I just can't believe what Steve McQueen has done with two out of these five films that he's managed to pull together, this series of films, you know, with such amazing talent to tell incredible stories about the Black experience that, again, I was ignorant about, that he's educating me, inspiring me, and as well, it has to be said, entertaining me. It's going to be fantastic to see this as a sort of weekly series of feature films from one of the best kind of directors going around just now. Imagine getting told you're going to see five new films from Steve McQueen over 5 weeks. Blows your mind. And it's not like it's being phoned in for streaming services. You look at this and you think that would be one of the best films of the year from Steve McQueen, and then he's saying with Lover's Rock, oh, this is one of the best films of the year from Steve McQueen. I can't wait to see what the other three are going to be.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's just a delight to see him back, because, you know, I maybe wasn't the biggest fan of 12 Years a Slave, but I couldn't fault Shame. I thought was an immense piece of filmmaking. Hunger as well. I guess, you know, there's always this thing that maybe people might feel that Steve McQueen is, his films are very heavy and very sort of issue based and stuff. You know, you had like the hunger strikes, you've got sex addiction, you've got slavery, you've got, you know, police, institutionalized police racism and stuff like this. But at least, you know, Lover's Rock is like the complete flip side of that. That film is just, you know, just moments of just sort of joy and happiness and stuff. Even though I was watching that one and thinking it almost looked like a period piece about having a house party full of other people and you're saying in one building, it was like, I mean, can you imagine? But Mangrove, I thought was excellent. It wasn't until like afterwards I realized it was like Sean Parks, who was in the lead role, who I remember from like Human Traffic about 21 years ago or something like that. And I think it's Simon Spruill, who played the racist cop. You know, he is getting a good sort of run of sort of slime ball characters at the moment in cinema and stuff like that. I thought Letitia Wright was great as well. And it's one of those films which is informative and sort of teaches you something, but it's also very well made and entertaining as well. And it's interesting, yeah, I think like it coming on basically the heels, basically coming at the same time as the Trial of Chicago 7. I think there's going to be a lot of comparison between the two, but I think they're both equally worthy of people's attention, I think. Well, number three, I'm going to go with the easy choice, and it was the choice of the majority of the audience of the London Film Festival, and this was another round directed by Thomas Vinterberg and teaming up once again following The Hunt with his star Mads Mikkelsen, about a group of friends in their sort of early 40s who decide to undertake an experiment under the belief that the human body has a blood alcohol content 0.05% lower than it should, and then designed to basically drink every day between working hours only to try and maintain that level to see if it improves their lives. Of course, initially it improves their confidence, to become better teachers, become better husbands, fathers and friends and stuff like this. But of course, you know, things obviously then take a turn into the darker side. I mean, the trailer, I can imagine some people will accuse this of being like Trainspotting, and that, you know, it glamorizes alcohol consumption, whereas, you know, if anyone had ever watched Trainspotting, I don't think you could ever say it glamorized heroin use, because you just have to actually watch the film to discover that it is not, in no way, it basically shows the dark side of heroin use. And likewise, this one doesn't shy away from showing the damage that alcohol can do. Obviously, you know, there's lots of discussions at the moment about alcohol consumption. You know, it's in the news almost every day with the restrictions and COVID. So, you know, you can go out for a drink, but you can only drink outside up until 10, but you can't drink inside. And then more people are drinking at home and stuff like this. There's a huge thing, but, you know, it examines it from the Danish perspective. But I think all the performances are fantastic. And, you know, it's a film which can go very dark, but ultimately is, I think, a celebration of life. And I mean, that final sequence, I don't want to spoil it for anyone who hasn't seen it yet, but that final sequence is, I think it's impossible to leave the cinema with or virtual screening without a huge smile on your face.
It seems to be one of the scenes that most people have kind of picked as their highlight of the film festival. Yeah, this was a really good pick, and I think this is one that's going to be, again, I think it's going to be successful for sort of independent cinemas. You know, they're doing a really interesting kind of blend at the moment, I feel, with future streaming films, with indie kind of favourites, and sort of some of kind of British cinema's films that maybe just wouldn't have kind of got as good a run as they might have done in sort of current circumstances. But I can see a film like this, especially with the Audience Award, the buzz and critical review, starring Mads Mikkelsen, I can see this one getting a nice buzz of people turning up for sort of screenings at local indies and so on. And I'm excited to see how well that'll do at places like Glasgow Film Theatre, Belmont and the Film House, and kind of, I think it's due soon, maybe next month or later this month.
Yeah,
I think
it's slated for a November release from Studio Canal. So yeah, I know that they're going to give it a huge push over here. I think it is the Danish contender for the Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film, so I think it'll do very well, and I think it has the potential to have some breakout appeal. You know, Parasite earlier showed that people are willing to take a chance on some subtitled foreign language cinema, so I think this one will do very well, I think. So yeah, so what have you got next for your highlight?
So I've gone for at number two, and that is Possessor by Brandon Cronenberg. So Tasso Voss, an elite corporate assassin, uses brain implant technology to take control of other people's bodies to terminate high profile targets. As she sinks deeper into her latest assignment, Voss becomes trapped inside a mind that threatens to obliterate her. So I don't think that sounds like a typical film festival description. You could imagine that, you might hear that and think, oh, that must be like the new Will Smith movie or the big action adventure. I mean, you watch a lot of films at film festivals, and there's always things in there that shock and surprise you and come out of left field. Not so much this year, I kind of found. I thought a lot of what I watched was kind of what I expected things to be. Yeah, there was the odd surprising scene or the little twist, but by and large, everything was what I kind of expected going in. Possessor, I expected something a little bit crazy and mental. I, you know, within the first few minutes, I felt I'd understated how crazy this film was going to be. I mean, you watch a film like this, I mean, it's a debut feature from Brandon Cronenberg. Yeah, I'm sure there can be arguments about nepotism and how he got a chance to make this kind of movie, baby, you know, but similar to sort of Duncan Jones and his background with someone like David Bowie, you watch this and you go, wow, what's he going to do next? I can't wait to see that. I mean, this film left such a strong impact on me. I thought it was the second most enjoyable film I saw at the festival. It put me into real
enjoyable.
Yeah, it is tough to watch, but it was a film like this where I was thinking, like, I've been deprived of films like this year, where it's something that has a really dark edge, some interesting use of violence and gore and stuff like that. You know, those aren't the type of films that we've been catered to this year. You know, films like that have often been either delayed, or they were maybe going to be the October releases and then find themselves pushed back. I think you look at this film, it's got Neon behind it. Neon had, by and large, a pretty interesting, successful kind of London Film Festival. They really got behind it with, three films of theirs made it to the festival. So Possessor, I thought, just, it was what I needed. We always say that when you're watching a film at a film festival, you sometimes just need something like this, something a bit different to kind of throw up how you're kind of feeling what you're seeing that day. And I think Possessor is going to be, you know, cliche to say it, but it's going to be a really interesting kind of cult hit. And I just thought, wow, how well it was shot, the score, the acting, the use of violence. It was incredibly, incredibly interesting to watch. And I think I can see it being a film where it's going to split audiences, but wow, you know, great. I mean, that was obviously, I think I touched on it, was the third film from Neon at the festival. You had Shirley, this, and Ammonite. So yeah, great to see Neon getting behind the festival like that.
Yeah, no, this was just outside my top three. It was in my sort of, definitely in my top five of the festival. And yeah, that, I mean, in the first 5 minutes, yeah, Brandon Cronenberg sets out his stall and is like, yeah, the apple does not fall far from the tree with that man. It is an incredibly shocking, visceral, violent start to a movie. And then it just sort of snowballs from there. I think Andrew Riseborough is great, but I think the real sort of standout of this film was Christopher Abbott. He was a young guy from Girls. He's been in films such as James White, which is at the Glasgow Film Festival a few years. Not many people have seen that film, but I thought it was terrific in that. He's been in the likes of sort of It Comes at Night and stuff like that. But he has the most difficult job as the subject of essentially the weapon that Andrea Riseborough is using to commit an assassination. So not only does he have to play himself, but then he also has to play Andrea Riseborough playing himself as she controls him and stuff like that. So it's a really sort of complex layer performance. I thought he was great. Like you say, it's incredibly violent in a few places, and yeah, that will put some people off, but I think it will just appeal to a whole other branch of people. I think, yeah, this was destined to be one of those sort of the cult hits of the year. There's some slight confusion, I think, in the fact that the version in America is called Possessor Uncut, and we got Possessor. Apparently they're the same version, but apparently I don't know if that means that at some point the US will get a cut version, perhaps. I don't know. But as far as I can tell, there was no cuts made to the version that we saw over here. And I think you can tell, because I don't know how much more extreme it could have been. And yeah, no, it's, I think I called it in my review, it's basically sort of the Manchurian Candidate meets Being John Malkovich times Existence. And yeah, that's sort of perfect. So yeah, I think this one is out in the US at the moment. I think it's again maybe like a late November release for the UK. So I think people are definitely going to be catching on to this one. And like you say, it's only going to be uphill for Brandon Cronenberg. And I think he's, you know, with his first two films, he's sort of shown that he's, you know, got some of his dad's, you know, sort of skills in sort of dealing with body horror and sort of weird sort of issues with sort of sci-fi and technology. But I think he's really going to branch out and become his own man after this, I think.
Definitely. So what's your number two?
My number two is going to be one of the films which I actually recommended. I was nearly going to go Wolfwalkers, but I'm going to go with One Man and His Shoes. And this was one of the ones that I had recommended. It's the documentary that was about the making of the Air Jordan shoe and the Nike sort of campaign around that. It sort of goes right back to the very beginning, where Michael Jordan is coming into basketball, and how at that point basketball players advertised shoes, whether it was like the Converse All-Star or something like that. Nike then decided to flip everything on its head and make a shoe that advertised a player. And so yeah, it follows the Nike campaign around the marketing of the shoe, and how they basically were given a huge leg up by the fact that the NBA banned the shoe, because apparently it didn't conform because it was a mixture of red, black and white, whereas basketball shoes at that point were only meant to be white. And then, of course, as soon as they banned it and made it prohibited, everybody wanted it. And then, of course, limited amounts being produced basically jacked it up and became the must-have shoe. And it basically follows the, it speaks to people who are involved in the production, the marketing, speaks to collectors and stuff like that. And it basically, at that point, has you on your phone sort of going onto eBay looking for secondhand versions of Air Jordan ones. And, you know, at this point, I think we're onto like the Air Jordan 30 or something like that. There's been so many versions of it. It's like a $1 billion industry, and it's a really in-depth documentary that goes into a lot of detail and a lot of stuff which I didn't even know, because, I mean, the Air Jordan was kind of mentioned, obviously, in the Air, in the Last Dance documentary. This is perfect for anyone who's watched that and wants a bit more of a basketball hit this year. But there was an amazing deal where they gave Michael Jordan, like, say, like, I think it was like a $3 million up front, you know, to basically get his name and stuff like that. And then they were going to give him $1 for every pair of shoes that was purchased. And at this point, they were imagining sales of around $3 million by year three. It made $126 million in the first year. So basically, and then they looked at the contract and realized they hadn't put a cap on the royalties either. So basically, Michael Jordan, even though he doesn't play anymore, still makes about $130 million a year through them selling Air Jordans. So that's great. And then suddenly, the documentary Wrong Foot Shoe, and basically flips on its head and then looks at the darker side of the shoe and how people have been robbed, assaulted and killed to get these shoes. Basically, it goes into this look at the sort of the darker side of capitalism. It's kind of really unexpected, and I think it's going to leave a really sort of lasting impact on people who watch this, and will probably give you second thoughts before the next time you buy an expensive pair of trainers, I think.
Yeah, this was one I checked out off the back of your recommendation and really enjoying The Last Dance. And I found out at the beginning, I was like, oh, kind of seen this done already this year, and I felt really bad almost for the people involved, where you think you're making something, you're like, my god, we're telling something really unique here, and then you see something come along and do it in the absolute best possible manner, you're like, oh balls. But I really liked it when it made that pivot. That's when it went from retreading some of the Last Dance to, oh, this is really interesting, where it looked at sort of the social impact of those, that film. The shoes, because in the film you see the impact that Michael Jordan and the Bulls have on Chicago. But I like how this goes into the level of what does a pair of shoes, you know, related to the Chicago Bulls and Michael Jordan, what does that do to communities and neighborhoods? And I think they talked about the statistics for kind of people being robbed or attacked, assaulted. I can't even remember. I think it was maybe someone that had been murdered over a pair of shoes. It kind of blew your mind. And I thought it was a really interesting companion piece, and I know it's coming out soon here in the UK for people to see, so I think there'll be a lot more Chicago Bulls fans out there, or a lot more folk willing to check out a basketball documentary after this. And I would encourage people to definitely check out and keep the faith almost with it in the beginning, where don't think you've spent your money or taken the time out to watch the documentary again. You know, you're going to get something really interesting when that pivot kicks in. And I immediately am already thinking about breaking into that guy who had the massive collection and stealing his stuff and putting it on eBay.
I mean, I'm probably exactly the same with like my Star Wars figures and my Blade Runner stuff. But yeah, it's almost, yeah, like you say, it's a blessing and a curse that it's come out after The Last Dance. So there's going to be a lot more focus on it and a lot more people probably wanting to watch it. But at the same time, yeah, you are worried that, you know, it does cover some of the same ground. But I mean, that was probably maybe sort of one episode out of the sort of eight episodes of The Last Dance was probably focusing on the marketing of it. And it does, like, thankfully it does go in that different way, and it will give you a different perspective on it. So it's definitely worth a look, and interesting to see what director Yemi Bamro does next. But yeah, One Man in Shoes is released in some cinemas. I think it's definitely with the Everyman chain, but it'll probably be on streaming as well from October 23rd. So from this Friday, actually. So there you go. And so you've got one more recommendation for us from the London Film Festival, of course. So what's it going to be?
We are living in truly horrible times. We are a partisan planet. People are fighting against science. people are claiming they're fighting for individual freedoms, people are dying every day, everyone hates each other on social media, loves a subtweet, but on October 14th, something special happened, Alice. People united behind David Byrne's American Utopia, directed by Spike Lee, and were happy once again, believed that good times were ahead, and it was a filmed version of David Byrne's Broadway show, a unifying musical celebration that inspires audiences to connect each other and to the global community. Now, I work for a charity. I hear all that kind of fluff non-stop about plans, projects and pitches, but that description was so true. I've not seen a film make people kind of just be happy and talk about that they saw this film and praise it. You know, I think I saw nothing less than 5 stars for what was essentially a very kind of minimalistic stage and presentation that just made people all smile. Nearly two hours of talking heads music, and that's all it took to make the world feel like a little bit of a better place. So if Joe Biden or whoever's looking to out Trump, just get on a platform designed by David Byrne's American Utopia and watch the people of the world unite behind it. All it takes is some Talking Heads music and some Spike Lee direction. It was just an amazing day. I had a huge smile on my face for the rest of the day. It was similar to films in the past, like say Sing Street, Once, you know, Hearts Beat Loud, where it's like, film finishes, right, where's that soundtrack, where's that playlist? And off I go, and it's been on my mind ever since. Great, great film, and I know it'll be available on HBO Max, I think maybe now or very shortly.
You know, I was one of those people that also gave it 5 stars when I watched it. I don't know what I was expecting, but I wasn't expecting that. I knew it was set at the stage show, but I had in my head it was maybe going to be more of a mix of Talking Heads songs, but then also Talking Heads and maybe more sort of like backstage interviews with David Byrne and stuff like that. I didn't realize it was just a straight recording of the show, but when I started watching it, I didn't care. I was swept along with it. And you know, he's an incredibly consummate professional performer. He is able to engage with the audience. You know, it's like, if that's his version of the American Utopia, I want in, you know. It's the perfect place for these times, I think, is just like you were saying. And I think what was interesting was Spike Lee's direction. You know, he does keep it very sort of tight on the, like you say, very minimalist setup in terms of it's basically an empty stage with sort of grey curtains around. You know, it's down to the sort of the lighting choices and the sort of camera angles and stuff in order to give every sort of individual song a different feel and stuff like that. The band all perform in the same grey suit. For some reason, they're not wearing shoes. A special credit has to go to the backing singer, the male guy with a mustache, who just seemed to almost pull focus every single chance he got. And at the end, he was playing one of those sort of keyboard flute things. And it was just like an incredible performance. I thought he was great in it. And I like the way that Spike Lee also had to clearly adapt his filming of the show. I think it was burning down the house when people in the audience and the stalls started to get up and dance. And that's when he had to sort of pull back and show that it wasn't, you know, that the entire crowd were basically getting right into this. And I mean, I'm interested to know, were you like a huge Talking Heads fan before this? I can't say that I was aware of maybe like 3 of like the big hits, but I hadn't seen like the other music documentary Stop Making Sense or anything like that. So I mean, were you a big fan before this?
No, but they were one of those bands where anytime I heard them, I liked them, but I never considered myself like a Talking Heads fan. It wasn't something I'd go, right, get that music on the car for a playlist, or I want to run to this or walk to this. It just wasn't very common. There'd be a couple songs that were go-tos, but not that much, to be honest. But I feel completely changed, and I'm the same. I want to check out that other documentary now. And yeah, I just wish I could have been there to have seen that performance. When I noticed it had been in London a few years ago, I was like, why didn't I know about this then, and so on. I feel so envious of people that got to experience that live. It looks like a really great communal experience, when you see sort of how the crowd reacts, I think.
Well, I don't know if it's just going to be Broadway whenever Broadway reopens, but I did hear a rumour that he may be bringing the show back off the base itself, off the popularity of the recording show. He might bring it back. So maybe, hopefully he can, and maybe London might, in the West End, might be able to open up before Broadway and he can bring it over here. Of course, then you've got to get to London and all that, but that's another thing to worry about. But, you know, I was very surprised last night when it didn't win Best Documentary at the London Film Festival Audience Awards, given the amount, the fact that everyone I'd seen had basically universally praised the film and given it 5 stars. I was very surprised it didn't even make the top three. Maybe the fact it wasn't, it maybe blows it. Is it? I'm not sure if you classify it as a documentary. It's like one of those sort of live studio recordings. So maybe that was maybe the reason that people voted for other documentaries. But I certainly voted it as my best documentary of the thing. But I knew you were going to pick that one somewhere in your list, which is why I went with One Man in His Shoes on my recommendations. I had a feeling you were going to pick that one.
I'm so predictable.
Yeah. So I guess it's now time for my final pick from the London Film Festival. And this happened to be a film which I had no intention of seeing. I hadn't really known anything about it. And it just happened to be that it fell between the gap. I think it was between Another Round and One Man in His Shoes. And so I just decided to keep watching movies because I was on holiday from work and I had nothing better to do. I should have been writing reviews, but I figured I'll give it a watch. And this was Rose, A Love Story. And this is directed by first-time director Jennifer Sheridan and written by first-time writer Matt Stocco, who also stars as Sam in the film. And he plays a man who is looking after his wife, Rose, and they are living out in a cabin in the woods. And this is technically a horror film. Technically, it is also, as you might tell, a love story. But she can't go outside. She must stay indoors at all times. She has a mysterious illness and he's doing his best to protect her. And he does that a number of different ways. He sort of has a deal with someone in town who comes up and brings gas to power the generators out there. He sort of catches their own food in the woods. He's a real sort of, you know, man's man, woodsman, sort of can do all that sort of stuff. But then there's other times where late at night when she goes to bed, he goes upstairs and reads a book in a UV room and gets leeches on his legs and fills them with blood. And then she consumes them later on. So what I really liked about this one, because I didn't really know anything about it, it kind of describes it in the description as to what it is a modern take of, but I didn't know that. And I liked the ambiguity of it and the fact that it never sort of really gives you a definite answer as to what the illnesses and what's going on. In some ways, it really sort of reminded me of It Comes at Night, which probably will put you off because I know that you weren't a fan of that one. But what really sort of sold the movie here is the fact that it's the central relationship between the two. And they're played by Matt Sugo and Rose is played by Sophie Rundle. Apparently, they are a real couple in real life, possibly following after the film, but you can really tell that they've got a really strong bond in this, and that's what sells it. But you know, this is a horror film apparently, and therefore things have to go wrong. And as always with anything like It Comes at Night or any season of The Walking Dead, when a stranger wanders into the woods and basically comes upon their cabin, everything goes to crap when you let the outside world in. And I'm not going to spoil it any more than that, but I thought this was a really sort of impressive debut. It's sort of the tension was great, the mood was fantastic, and it really sort of was sold by the two central performances in this. And I think this could be one of the sort of breakout hits of the festival. It doesn't have a UK distributor as of yet, but I feel it should probably get picked up. And if it gets billed as an out-and-out horror film, people will probably be disappointed. It's got some shocking moments in it, but really it's more about mood, atmosphere, and about the performances. So that's the one I wanted to rave about, because everyone has probably already heard of stuff like Another Round and whatever, but this was a real find for me. Like I say, hadn't planned on seeing it, just happened to stumble on it, and I'm very glad that I did.
I really enjoyed this one. I completely agree that comparisons are there with It Comes at Night. I actually thought this one was a better one than It Comes at Night. But yeah, this was a real surprise movie. And I think this one's going to be a bit of a breakout. It just, you watch that and you're immediately just sort of hooked in. I thought it had such a really good premise, and the payoff is worth the wait. I know that people maybe felt love that It Comes at Night just maybe didn't deliver on sort of the premise, or maybe they felt it was a bit misleading. Ultimately, maybe I wonder if I had gone in to see this blind, if I had gone in to see It Comes at Night as blind as I did with this one, maybe my opinions would be slightly changed on it. I'm not too sure. But yeah, it's an excellent film. I can't recommend it highly enough either.
Yeah, no, I think the issue we'll have, similar like you say, with It Comes at Night, is going to be the marketing campaign and how they market it. Because I definitely remember the trailers for It Comes at Night did make it look like there was going to be more violence and horror and action to it, and where, as a lot of the time, it was just a lot of people sitting around a kitchen table. So again, this film, it also features a lot of people just sitting around a kitchen table, but like you say, the payoff at the end is worth it. But yeah, it will depend on how they go with the marketing of it. But yeah, no, this is a definite breakout hit of the fest, and hopefully some distributor in the UK picks it up and runs with it, and hopefully we'll be able to see it in cinemas probably next year, I would expect. So there we go. So that brings us to the end of our review of the London Film Festival. Some recommendations for you there to keep an eye out for at cinemas and on streaming. But as always, we do like to recommend something else that we've been enjoying outside of the festival. So Lee, what have you got for the listeners?
I'm going to recommend my second neon film of the week, and that's Totally Under Control, which is out on VOD just now in the United States. And it's from director Alex Gibney, who might be familiar with some people as the director behind Enron, the Great American Scandal, Going Clear, the Scientology one, and We Steal Secrets, the WikiLeaks documentary. So this documentary, you might argue that it's potentially a bit early releasing something like this, but it puts a spotlight on the White House's failed response to the COVID-19 outbreak and how it could have been prevented. And it features testimony from public health officials, civil servants, and ultimately is a testament to hard-hitting reporting. This was finished in the edit about one day before sort of the Bob Woodward revelation that Trump knew how dangerous it was. But what makes it interesting, and I know people will be like, well, why do we need a film like this now in the midst of something? It's only half time, is how badly things are just now. You watch this and you leave with a real sense of despair and fear for where things are happening at just now in America. You know, there's a lot of things that can be taken to be happening here in the West, but it's one of those ones that you watch this and you think, change is perhaps needed at government level in America. It's, you know, it is there to influence, but it presents the information in cold facts. It puts health officials front and center, and they talk through what it was like in those early days, the lack of getting what they needed, the lack of people listening to them. You know, absolutely stunning piece of documentary, and I can't recommend it highly enough. Again, I was a bit hesitant to dive into something like this at this point of time, and because of how depressing the world is. But it's one of those things you watch that and you think, what a fantastic piece of documentary filmmaking at a critical stage.
Yeah, no, I saw the trailer for this, a very angry, hard-hitting trailer, but it looks like an essential piece of filmmaking, and I expect there's probably going to be quite a few people doing a double bill of that and the new Borat film ahead of the election in a couple of weeks. Basically lots of films coming out designed to skewer Trump, but I mean it's all of his own doing, by the looks of the trailer for the documentary. It was all by his own doing, so yeah, no, I'm definitely going to try and catch that one. But like you say, you'll just need to throw on David Byrne's American Utopia immediately afterwards to cheer yourself up.
Yeah.
And for me, you know, having watched 24 films at the festival, you know, it was not much time for anything else. But I did manage to catch a documentary, and I'm going to recommend it to you, Lee, if you have not seen this one already. I saw this one about 20 years ago. It's called Beyond the Mat, a documentary about the WWF. That's right, the WWF. That's what they were called back then. This is a documentary which would not be made now. This was like a guy who was a documentary filmmaker who was just a fan of wrestling and decided to make a documentary about it, and was basically given full access to the behind the scenes workings of the WWE, and would sort of speak with Vince McMahon and stuff about the designing of new stars. And then it sort of, he looks at stars on the rise and then stars on sort of aging to retirement, such as Terry Funk and stuff. But one of the major sort of things is it sort of follows the trajectory of Mick Foley at the time, where he'd been thrown through the Hell in the Cell cage. And, you know, if anyone wants to go, well, wrestling isn't real, it's all fake, it's all predetermined, there's an incredible sequence where he is wrestling The Rock at the Royal Rumble in an I Quit match. And basically the documentary filmmaker follows Mick Foley's family, who are sat front row. There is two young kids at the time, probably like 8 and 9, sort of watching their dad getting mercilessly struck in the head with a steel chair several times, to the point where they start crying and the mum has to take them backstage because they can't watch it anymore, and he has to come back blood streaming down his face going, look kids, I'm actually okay. So it sort of shows like the true sort of cost sometimes of this sports entertainment. And I think if anyone sort of watches this, you can maybe see where maybe Darren Aronofsky was inspired in part for The Wrestler, starring Mickey Rourke as well.
Did you say this was a series? Because I think I saw one where it was, I think it was maybe Vice or something, where it was a documentary about Chris Benoit or something like that. That was a stunning kind of wrestling documentary as well. I can't remember if it was sort of the Beyond the Mat, the series.
No, this was just a one-off. I know, yeah, I know there was one sort of looked at the sort of the dark side of the Chris Benoit.
That was it, the dark side of the ring, I think, yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, no, this one was made in 1999. It's on Netflix just now, and yeah, it's sort of a different time. Wrestling is now much more apparently family friendly and stuff like that. But this is when, you know, they were doing barbed wire matches and setting people on fire and stuff like that. And it sort of shows the rise of ECW at the same time. So it sort of encompasses a lot of the wrestling things. But it's, if anyone's got said, well, it's all fake and whatever, this will probably change your mind, I think.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to check that out. I saw your post about it earlier on. I was like, I'm not a fan of wrestling, but I find it as a cultural institution very fascinating. And that Chris Benoit documentary was fantastic. So I think I'll definitely check it out.
Excellent. Oh, you see, I've convinced him to watch a wrestling film. Oh, he's made my week.
There we go. There's our review in a few weeks' time.
Exactly. Well, we'll be back next week with a Halloween spooktacular episode, which will star our very own Scream Queen, Kim Morrison, who is choosing the topic that we're going to see. We don't know what we're going to talk about yet, but she's going to come up with something quite special, I think. So we'll see you then. Bye-bye.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.
Welcome to Nerd Party.